I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
On this episode of The Trade Guys, we'll talk about President-elect Biden's pick for USTR, Katherine Tai. Plus, we'll do a year in review and talk about the biggest trade news of 2020. And we'll chat about the future of trade policy and what changes the incoming Biden administration may bring. Stay tuned for all that and much, much more on this final 2020 episode of The Trade Guys. Thanks to all of our listeners and have a happy new year. Trade Guys, it's that time of year again. It's the end of the year review. It's always a happy time, even in COVID, because it's, you know, it's the holiday time and we get to talk about all the things that Tariff Man did over the past year. But first, we should talk about President-elect Joe Biden's pick of Katherine Tai as USTR. Guys, what do you think?
Well, look, I think it's fair to say Bill and I are both fans of Katherine. We've worked with her most recently as trade counsel to the House Ways and Means Committee, but she's been a pro in this space for a long time. She's a very capable individual. It's a big step from staff basically to a member of the cabinet, but she is highly capable.
Yeah, I think it's a good pick. I agree exactly with what Scott said. I think particularly disappointing, but then that changed yesterday, was that while there was a lot of praise from Democrats, Republicans were silent. Even Republicans who know her and have worked with her and respect her. That block was broken yesterday when we, CSIS, did our biannual former USTR event. And Senator Portman went out of his way to say what a good pick it was, which I think is good for Katherine because of the eight of the former USTRs, he's the only one that can vote because he's in the Senate.
Yeah, he's on the Finance Committee. Yeah,
so it was real news when he said that at your, you know, annual USTR event, Bill.
And he did it gratuitously, you know, there was no prompting. So I hope that's kind of broken the logjam. And I hope will mean that she will sail through.
So you're saying you didn't poke the bear in the virtual green room. You weren't like, you know, goosing up Senator Portman. You weren't like, you know, hey, Senator Portman, none of your party has said anything. And, you know, you could make news at CSIS. Was nothing like that behind the scenes.
I was tempted, but he joined late because he was voting. So I didn't have the chance.
As is typical of United States senators.
The other thing he did, which was very, and I was going to congratulate him on it, was very, very smooth. When he was talking about agendas, he managed to slip in the U.S.-Swiss free trade agreement. And I recall that he has been chairman of the Swiss caucus.
That's a happening item.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, everybody's on pins and needles about that one. I mean, come on.
I remember going to meetings of the Swiss caucus, and there are, I think, three members of Congress with Swiss ancestry, and he's one of them. He's been the chairman of it, but it was very smooth the way he sort of slipped that in and nobody said anything. I think the challenge he's going to face is the same one that some other cabinet members are going to face, which is sort of the what seems to be developing the administration. It's kind of an inside group and an outside group. You know, in the White House, he's surrounded himself with old colleagues, and I mean old in the sense of old and in the sense of having been with him a long time. That kind of makes sense. You want people that are on the same page, that are not having ferocious infighting like we've seen the last few years.
You got to have your people.
But then, you know, that leaves a lot of cabinet members who don't have those relationships kind of in a different position, and it remains to be seen how that will work. My guess is that she will end up playing a role actually not that different from Lighthizer's in the sense that she will be the expert in the room. She will know more about the subject matter than anybody else in the room, and she will know how to accomplish the president's objectives. I hope that means that she's in the room all the time when decisions are made, rather than simply somebody who gets orders to carry out. So I think it'll be all right, but I think that's one of the things that she kind of has to worry about.
Yeah, when you recall that back in the heady days of 2017, that President Trump actually thought the Secretary of Commerce was responsible for trade. He thought, well, in this case, Wilbur Ross was his trade guy, and that Bob Lighthizer was somehow Wilbur's attorney.
Right.
But frankly, it was the excellence and the skill of Ambassador Lighthizer that earned him a great deal of respect, I think, both within the West Wing, but also—
I give him a lot of credit. I wouldn't give him quite that much credit. What he did was brilliant, is he just stood aside and watched Wilbur Ross implode.
Well, yeah, and he was always there to fix it.
Exactly.
Demonstrated his capability, which earned him respect.
So what does Catherine Tai need to do to get into the inner circle? I mean, or does she already have relationships with people like Jake Sullivan, you know, the national security advisor, and other key staff in the White House that she can really be in those meetings?
Yeah, I don't know if she does or not. That's a good question. I guess maybe we should ask her. I invited her to attend the event yesterday, since most of it was directed at her in terms of advice. So I should follow up and see if she listens.
That's a hell of an invite. So the incoming USTR gets to sit with all the old bulls, and it's like kind of like a firing squad.
You can see why she said no.
Yeah, that's the party I want to come to. Yeah, just sit her right next to Carla Hills and Bill Brock and see what happens, right?
Yeah, here, hold this bullseye right in front of you. That's right. Just stop right there.
No, maybe, you know, sit her next to Charlene Barshefsky and see if, you know, it works out, you know, see how that goes. See if Charlene has any advice for her, you know.
If you want to see the really interesting one, tune in the next time we do the former USTR event, so we have Lighthizer there with the other eight of them.
Oh, that would be hilarious.
Oh, yeah.
That's must-see TV.
Yeah, that is going to be great. That is truly going to be great. But, like, hopefully by then, you know, enough time will have passed that people will be able to reflect.
You're such an optimist, Andrew.
I try to be. Well, anyway, so we're looking forward to the new USTR, and hopefully we'll be doing, you know, lots of great events with her at CSIS. Guys, let's turn to year in review. What should we talk about first with Tariff Man and his year in review?
Well, look, it's a lot of us, including myself, are glad to see 2020 fade into the rearview mirror. But it's been a fascinating year from a trade policy standpoint, and there's some things that are happening in the broader sphere of public opinion that I think will affect policy into the future. So if I had to pick the most significant development, it was the rapid movement of voter opinion about China that happened during 2020. It was a chart that you could see it happening as Pew and Gallup and other polling organizations asked the question routinely. During 2020, China moved from sort of speculatedly an unfair trader to an outright menace. And so the American people are in a very different place than they were a year ago on dealing with China as an entity. And that's going to have a big policy effect into the future.
And that's a bipartisan
feeling, yes.
Because this is among, when Pew broke it down, wasn't just Republicans, it's Republicans and Democrats both feel basically the same way about China.
Yeah, it'll be almost impossible to go back to the way things were in terms of restoring policy dialogues and those kinds of things, just because of the dramatic shift in public opinion.
You know, and we have to also say that a lot of that polling was done pre-COVID as well.
Oh, yes. It started pre-COVID.
Yeah, so those attitudes that we saw about China were before COVID. And then, of course, you know, after COVID, you know, slightly ticked up, but the sentiment was there.
My only disagreement is timing. It's probably the most important event, but I think it's the most important event of the last 5 years, not the last year. This is a trend that started even before Trump, and I think it's a trend that's due probably more to Xi Jinping and his policies than it is to anything that's happening here. You know, he's taken the country backwards in economically toward more state control, more of a statist model, more of an authoritarian state. He's committed these, you know, horrible human rights atrocities in Xinjiang province. You know, he shut down Hong Kong. He's taken aggressive naval actions in the South China Sea. I mean, he's managed to irritate or alienate virtually everybody, certainly in our country. But look, you know, if you look at the way he's squeezing the Australians, they're practicing economic coercion against friends and neighbors, really. And nobody should be surprised that, you know, that this has happened. I mean, I agree with Scott. It's bipartisan. It's significant. It's going to be long lasting. But it's been going on for a while and building up. And there's not a real sign that he's got the message, that anything's going to change.
Yeah, it's sort of a preference cascade. It now is sort of reinforced in public opinion that China is a major problem. And I don't know how you reverse that.
Well, and so President-elect Biden worked with Xi Jinping as vice president when he was in the Obama administration, and he knows him and he knows the Chinese well. He's a foreign policy expert himself. Where does he pick up?
I think he'll try to pick up where he left off. and resume the relationship. I mean, he's inherently a guy who looks for areas of agreement, looks for areas of cooperation, and then tries to build on those. It's going to be hard for him because the pressure he's going to get from the Congress is going to be entirely to take a tougher line, and it's going to come from both parties, and it's going to particularly come from at least right now, there's at least four Republican senators who want to run for president in 2024, Hawley, Cotton, Cruz, and Rubio. And they're all going to spend 4 years telling him he's soft on China.
Not to mention Nikki Haley and, you know, Pompeo. Yeah, and
Trump's not going to go away because he's talking about running too. And whether he does or not, he's going to spend 4 years trying to maintain control of the party apparatus. So
wait a minute. Stop the president. You don't think Trump's going to go away?
There's a blinding glimpse of the obvious for today's trade, guys.
Okay. All right. I just want to make sure that, you know, we got that out. All right.
Yeah. Stop the presses.
Stop the presses. Okay.
When I give speeches about this, Scott and I do it. I say, you know, when you talk about forthcoming trade policy, you do it by contrasting Biden and Trump, because guess what? Trump is not going away.
Yeah.
And he's still going to be out there tweeting at everybody, unless Twitter cuts him off on January 21st, which would be interesting to see what happens, because
he'll find something else.
When you're not president, you don't have quite the same latitude, I think.
Well, as Maureen Dowd told Bob Schieffer and I for our book, you know, it doesn't matter whether, you know, the message is delivered by carrier pigeon, Twitter, Snapchat, whatever, the narrative arc is the narrative arc.
And I think that's not going to change. So getting back to Biden, I think there's got to be a summit. There always is, probably in the first 6 months, here, there, somewhere in between. I think what they'll do is do what always happens here, you know, set up some kind of framework for further discussions. And it'll have a new name, because presidents always give these things new names, but it'll be a forum for addressing ongoing issues. I think he'll probably begin with areas where there's common ground. The biggest one was climate, where the Chinese are also seized with it, because it's frankly a political issue in China. You know, when you can't breathe the air and can't drink the water, you've got a problem. And they've got a boatload of environmental problems. So maybe he'll try to build on that. He'll talk to them about North Korea, because they have very ambivalent feelings about North Korea. He'll probably raise some other areas where we might be able to, on Iran, where we might be able to get cooperation. And, you know, because if the United States goes back into the Iran agreement, the JCPOA, that might help increase cooperation with the other parties to that agreement, which included China. So I think you start there and then you get to the tough stuff. And for him, Biden, the tough stuff is going to include human rights. You know, he's been very clear about that. And we'll see how long that lasts. I think I've said before, other presidents have said they're going to do that, and they have, but it hasn't lasted very long. We'll have to wait and see. But I think there's no question it's going to start out that way. And the Chinese are going to have to be prepared for that response. He's going to have to talk about Xinjiang. He's going to have to talk about Hong Kong. He's going to have to talk about journalists. You know, they just detained a Bloomberg journalist last week, a Chinese national, not a U.S. citizen. But, you know, the national security law there is very broad and very vague.
So what else do we need to be looking at in the rearview mirror here besides China? I mean, is it just all China?
Well, look, I would point to one thing that is, I think it's both a positive and it's something to watch for, which is, I think 2020 was the year that Democrats in Congress made peace with North American trade. They did it through the USMCA, which the process mostly happened in 2019. But having said that, you know, this has been an area where there's been sort of a war about trade policy and about trade agreements that seized the Democratic Party really since the Clinton administration wrapped up the NAFTA and things moved on. And so I think that's vitally important, because we spent almost 25 years with a very hostile, very partisan environment on international trade and specifically trade agreements. They got jammed through by the skin of their teeth with primarily Republican votes and a handful of Democrats, and it was uncomfortable for both parties and politically very sort of political capital intensive for the president who wanted to do them. And so I don't know if we're past that, but I do know that the issue of trade in North America with the USMCA, oddly, Trump's main trade accomplishment, also created a sense of, I don't know if I'd call it peace or a resolve within the Democrats, most of whom voted for the agreement and were willing to sort of realize that trade in North America is actually in their constituents' interests on a broad basis, but also something we need to foster. So what excited part for me is that it creates some political creativity, some space for a new coalition, which is badly needed.
I don't disagree with that, but I also think that we're heading into a year of Europe for a lot of reasons. The whole Trump administration really featured an attack on Europe, an attack on NATO, attack on European trade policy. The relationship is probably as bad as it's been in the post-war era. And the Europeans have put out a few olive branches, particularly in the trade area, about the need to work together on AI, work together on digital issues. And some of them have said the same thing we have said, need to work together on China. They're coming around on that very slowly. You can be cynical about those initiatives. I am, because if you work your way through them, they're very much in the way of, you know, we need to work together. If you just do things our way, everything will be fine, which is what they've been saying for 40 years. So I'm not sure there's a lot new there, but they're clearly making an overture to the new administration. And it's, I think, a very important thing to follow up on. We both confront the same very large challenge, which is China. And what we should have learned from Trump is that if you try to take that on by yourself, you're not going to do very well, which is what's happened. So the logic of trying to do some things together makes enormous good sense. And so I think what you'll see is that the initiative will be picked up on, and then we'll see how far it goes. I mean, the Europeans have simultaneously made clear they're not talking about TTIP, you know, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. They're not talking about a comprehensive thing, but they're doing a lot of things that matter enormously for us because they are trying to become the world's leader in regulation, and particularly regulation in e-commerce and the digital space. Digital services taxes, competition policy, they're going after, you know, the GAFA companies, Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. They're doing has enormous implications for us, and there's just a lot to talk about. So I think it's going to be a year for Europe. And I say that not because to say that it won't be a year for China, too, but Europe's going to be on the screen in a way that it has not been in the Trump administration.
Well, looking at it that way, when then Vice President Biden left office, the Obama-Biden administration was also very high on TPP. And, you know, Bill, you talked about how Biden's going to pick up where he left off. Is that something he's going to try to pick up again?
I think eventually, but not right away. That one is not that hard to script out. I mean, you can sort of see the moving parts. His security advisors are going to tell him, you have to get back in because if you want to reinforce the U.S. presence in the Pacific and make clear that it's permanent and strong, you can't just do that by sending aircraft carriers through the South China Sea. You have to have an economic presence. But then his trade advisors will come in and say, well, wait a minute, it's toxic politically. You need to think about this very carefully. Fortunately, you know, there's a Democratic game plan on this. Clinton did it with NAFTA. Obama did it with Korea. Pelosi did it with what Scott was talking about, USMCA. And it's simple to explain. It's not easy to execute. You say, the current agreement's flawed. I'm going to fix it. You go have a negotiation. You pronounce it fixed, and then you rejoin. Of course, the difficulty there is you go have a negotiation. And what the other countries have been clear about, particularly after Trump withdrew, what they said is, well, if you want to get back in, you know, you're welcome to apply, but there's no free lunch. If you want to make changes, then we want to make changes too. So it's going to be a real negotiation, but I would say 2-3 years he goes back in.
Not only will it not be easy in terms of negotiation, but it'll require getting alignment of the Congress, because Trade Promotion Authority, which was last approved by the Congress in 2015, expires mid-year 2021. And so they'll need new authority. They're going to have to make arrangements to get that through a Congress that has small majorities in both parties.
I have a plan for that.
You have a plan for that? Aligning Congress?
We had a conversation about this with Sarah Ladislaw, who's running CSIS's climate and energy program. And so we started to think about this. Right now, I think the Biden folks are not inclined to renew TPA right away. As Scott said, it's a heavy lift politically. They're going to say it's a distraction when we've got all this other stuff to work on. And I think, you know, that's what they think. And in absent other interference, that's what will happen. It occurs to me, though, that you've got members of Congress that want to move on climate. Biden wants to move on climate. Climate includes border adjustment measures, which the EU is on the verge of proposing. We're going to have to play in that space. And TPA renewal is the place to play. And I think what's going to happen is people in the climate world are going to tell the Biden administration, you need to move on this. We need to move legislation. It's not going to move by itself, but as part of a trade bill, it's got a better shot. So I think they're going to get more interested in it as time goes on.
All right, here's a big year-end question. Trump may be leaving office, but some of what's left behind, and as you said, as we discussed before, he's not going away, a lot of the America First stuff or elements of the America First isn't going away. And we've already seen with President-elect Biden, you know, some of the things that he's incorporated into his remarks indicate that, you know, he's got to incorporate America First into what he's doing, too, to speak to the 75 million voters who voted for President Trump. How does he do that? And how does that play out in trade?
Good question. I'm waiting for Scott to answer. I think the Buy American thing, if all he ends up talking about is procurement, I think that's not a very big blip. 95% of our federal government procurement is already domestic. So you're talking about, you know, doing something that sounds big and good, but in economic terms is not. It's not good for the Canadians, and it's a distraction for the Europeans, but it's not huge. I'm afraid this is going to become a debate about reshoring and bringing American companies back home. His campaign documents had a plan for tax sticks and carrots. Carrots if you come home, sticks if you don't. That'll require legislation. That's not something he can just do. But if that's the debate, then we're going to have kind of a bigger and more complicated debate about what the role of America in the world should be and whether it's really in our competitive interest to make everything here and bring everything home.
Look, we're about to face what I think is going to be a pretty bad first quarter economically, first quarter of 2021. And given the new administration and given what there'll be a strong interest in getting people back to work and getting the economy going again, particularly with the arrival of a couple of safe and effective vaccines for COVID, I think a more comprehensive plan is going to help the administration move beyond the specific things promised on the campaign trail that ultimately will have relatively little effect. So I'd look for a way to get the whole economy growing. And I think a growing economy is sort of the universal solvent here for specific controversies about America First or trade restrictions or reshoring.
Do we feel like there's a big infrastructure bill coming, getting people back to work out in the, you know, flyover states? What do you guys think?
That's not going to be good enough for the party's left wing, I don't think. This was the old, you know, what John F. Kennedy said when he did a tax cut, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. And I think what we've learned more recently is a rising tide doesn't lift all boats. It lifts some boats, but not others. Scott has talked about the K-shaped recovery. You know, people that are well off are going to do well and do better. People that are not well off, people in service sectors that are going to be slow to recover, hospitality, travel, they're not doing well, and they're not going to do well. And I don't think an infrastructure program is going to necessarily speak to their needs. I think you're going to have the left wing of the Democratic Party coming and saying, you really need to be more focused on the poor, the disadvantaged, the people that are being passed by the economy. And a general macro program is not going to be good enough.
I think that's right. Look, it's Main Street that will need the help. It's the local economy, which is principally a services economy. So it's not so much of an international trade issue, but that's there on the bottom leg of that K-shape. It's the small businesses in the rural communities. It's the independent restaurants. It's the people that we walk down the street in Washington, D.C., and you can see the shoeshine places closed, the dry cleaners closed. It's those kinds of businesses that have been hit the hardest. It's the asset light, high tech businesses that have accelerated and done extraordinarily well. I mean, sometime this afternoon, Tesla is going to join the S&P 500. So you know, there's been some amazing progress in accelerating tech. But at the same time, the people in sort of the Main Street service economy have been very hard hit and mostly want to get back to work. They want to get their dignity back. They want to do what they've done for their life's work.
And what their parents did.
Exactly. And for me, that's the main priority. But with solutions there, with reopening of the domestic services economy, I think you'll have the room to manage yourself away from the excesses of the Trump tariff policies and use that as part of the overall economic recovery.
So you do think that's going to be a focus of this administration?
Well, yeah, look, I think one of the ways you improve the dialogue with Europe and China is that you unwind some of the less effective and more abusive measures that were put in place. Maybe we could stop messing with European steel and aluminum just a little, okay? Because after all, they're integrated into our economy. Same with many of the tariffs on China through phase one did nothing but raise prices for American consumers. So I think there's opportunity.
And they pronounce aluminum funny.
So do the Canadians.
Oh, that's, yes, yeah, the Canadians.
Yes.
How do they pronounce it again?
Aluminium.
You know, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, they spell it differently. They add an I. So they're actually pronouncing it the way they spell it.
Well, we can't get into Canada right now anyway. They won't let Americans in. So, you know.
This is the sort of things you learn on the Trade Guys, though. That's why we appreciate our loyal listeners.
But we love our friends in Canada. We just want to be able to go visit again.
Well, that'll happen too.
I know. Well, we're not far. And let's end on an optimistic note. Vaccines are coming. This is great news.
And you know what? In the world of trade, supply chains actually worked really well.
Yeah.
Once you got past the initial demand shocks, the global economy did its job in the recovery. And it's impressive. That really goes the credit to the people who operate those supply chains, because they worked their tails off to make this work, to make sure products were on the shelf that we could buy.
Yeah. And they're really flowing now.
I think that's right. There's a panic effect. And things have stabilized. And we talked about trade data last week, I think. You know, recovery is underway, but it's going to be, I think, in the United States anyway, slower and more divided than we had hoped.
Well, Trade Guys, it's been a year. There's no doubt about it. It has been a year. We will very much look forward to being with all of our listeners in 2021. I'll look forward to seeing you guys in 2021. So we'll be back, same trade time, same trade channel in 2021. Trade Guys, happy new year, happy healthy new year, Merry Christmas, happy holidays, best to everybody.
Thank you. Best to our listeners.
Yes, thank you.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to the Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.